time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way, 'cause I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, loving you later as if at all.
Good afternoon. This is Between the Lines, and my name is Paul Smart, filling in for your regular host and producer, Ann Forbes Cooper. For this month's broadcast, we stopped in on Jean Fleming, who's been producing the Greenwich Village Halloween Parade in New York City out of her home on the historic Hudson River estate of Rokeby since the mid-1980s. She's also the producer of the upcoming Sinterklaas, a fabulous holiday event that takes place in Kingston in Rhinebeck and also involves many in Columbia and Greene counties. Before us, as we spoke with her, on Fleming's kitchen table was a flurry of small strips of colored paper. The organization for last month's 40th annual parade, with some 60,000 marchers and an audience in the millions. As we spoke, people came and went, and the whole crew made soup and cappuccinos. Let's listen in a bit.
All right, Liana wants to reschedule. Do we want to talk? Do you want me to do her at 9 or at 3?
9 is great because I'm gone by 9.
Okay,
I'll do 9. That'd be fantastic.
Okay, and that means we're done the Kickstarter too.
Yes.
Okay, all right. That is a big good thing. So what's happening is that we're right in the middle of doing this lineup. So
everything's a little, yeah.
Everything is in chaos at the moment, but it's getting sorted out.
My other question is,
how close
are
we to being at a break point for me where I could talk to Paul and then, so have a seat. You're in the production.
I know. This is good.
Well, you're right here.
Jean, the truth of the matter is that all my other questions are really questions for Matthew rather than for you. So I think we just got through all the questions I had for you.
That's good. Now, Thrill the World, I'm just looking at what's left for me. Thrill the World is still in his pocket. Broadway Bodies.
What about them?
Are they all set?
Well, we talked about them earlier, and we decided, what did we decide? We decided we would try to assign them an escort, and that we wanted to make sure someone good was on the end rope for this section, because they're the first
but
thing
they're in, there.
In the new section.
Did you get a contact for this guy, Nicholas, who's just walking in that section, at the head with me?
He's at the head with you. So I don't have... I call him Werewolf Guy, but knowing his name
here,
is great.
Take him down. All right. The last thing is Flynn and the New York Jedi. They're going to be... We've handled them, right? Flynn and the Jedi.
I don't have them... What do we have them? They're the Jedi lightsaber...
We're almost done. That's why I want to finish so that they...
No, this is great.
Jean, are they the Jedi lightsaber group?
What about the Jedi?
Many of the core crew that Jean Fleming works with to put together each year's giant Halloween parade in New York City or the upcoming Sinterklaas event that comes to Kingston on November 30th and then Rhinebeck on December 7th, attended Bard College, with which Fleming's maintained close contact since marrying a professor who was transferred there while she was still in her early 20s. Our talk covers much territory about her path from the Philadelphia area to Los Angeles and a vivacious involvement with the arts throughout the Hudson Valley that's lasted decades now. Along the way, we both started to wonder about the magical fashion in which careers build and real change gets affected in our lifetimes.
Associated colleges of the Mid-Hudson area. And that was the association of the 9 colleges, like up here, Vassar, Bard, New Paltz, SUNY, Ulster, I guess, Dutchess.
70s?
Yeah, we were in, I graduated from Bard in 70, I think, and then I got this job like right away in 71 or 72, I can't remember. And but right after I took the job, the association expanded to all 30 colleges above New York City. And I started to coordinate an arts program for those 30 colleges. And because in those days, well, one, the NEA dance touring program was very heavily funded. Mm-hmm. The CAPS program for the state Arts Council, Creative Artists and Public Service Program, was very heavily funded. So anyway, so what happened was I worked there and I started, it was also the time when student governments had a lot of money. So I convinced the student governments to not hire, you know, they'd all like were touring the same rock band, so that one would appear at SUNY New Paltz, then they would appear at Vassar, then they'd appear at Purchase, then they'd appear at whatever. And it was ridiculous. They were paying these people tens of thousands of dollars when what would have been easier and what I ultimately convinced them to do was to let me block book the bands and run buses. And any money I saved on the rock bands would go to the arts.
Oh, wow.
And so I went to rock concerts and rock conventions with these kids, and we planned the block bookings, and I planned the whole bus system, and suddenly I had the largest cooperative arts program in the country. And so I had NEA money, I had NISCA money, and I had this money that I generated, and then my board were the presidents of all the colleges, and so I got them to contribute money for my program. So I had this big program. Arts program. So I ran festivals in art, music, drama, dance, film, and poetry. Every art form. I had festivals. And as a result of this, I got to know, I toured the Alvin Ailey Company. I toured every major dance company because there were run-out performances for them. And I'd set up workshops, and they would come up, and they'd do workshops in the schools, and then perform.
And you were living in Annandale, or where?
At that point, I was living, in Barrytown. I was living next to the church. There was a little house there, and I lived there, and I did that. I ran the theater aspect, River Arts Repertory, with Larry Sacaro and Quasha. Right. I was the person who put that all together for them. And
was that before River Arts was over in...
It all kind of was semi-simultaneous.
Okay.
But yes, it was before he moved it all the way over to be in Bearsville.
Okay.
God, you're reminding me of things I haven't thought about for years.
Yeah, or things I've never heard of.
So anyway, I ran that program for, you know, quite a number of years, and then funding changed and presidents changed, and I don't know, things changed. And then while I was doing that, I got to know the people at Mohonk, and Mohonk hired me. I left that job, and then Mohonk hired me to create festivals for the Mountain House. Now we're in a time where there isn't a lot of money for the arts. That's kind of falling apart. And the Mountain House, they had had a bad
year.
The 80s. And the Mountain House, nobody was coming to the Mountain House. And there was a great guy there named Bob Dean, and then Pearl Smiley hired me to create programs that would bring people to the Mountain House. And I created the Mystery Weekends, the Chamber Music Weekend, the Star Parties, the just lots of things. Small is Beautiful, Explore the Tiny. I created like 15 events for them, with some of which are still going to this day. And I did that for a while. And then what happened then? I guess what happened was that there were the years when the gas prices went way up, and I was last hired, first fired. So I lost my job at Mohonk. They cut back people because it was costing so much to heat the place. So it must have been right around that time. Then Larry, we must have been doing that. CETA. Then we did the CETA program, and I got involved with Larry because I had met him, because Larry and Ann Bogart were all involved in the theater festivals that I did every year, because all the colleges brought theater productions to these festivals, area college theater. and then I met Larry, and I guess I did that, and then that money dried up, and then I'm trying to think what happened. Oh, that's what happened, right. I had a very good friend, Gigi Alvarez, who was in that company. And she was a terrific actress. She became my main actress for years and years. And what happened was that Gigi wanted to trace her roots back to Spain. She came from a Spanish aristocratic family. And so we decided to go on this trip together. And we went on this trip together to Spain, and we went to Morocco, and I got hepatitis, and I got really sick. And I was living here in this house. You know, I moved here, I don't even remember, in 70. So then what happened was that we went on this trip, and I got sick. And I came back, and I was really sick and really depressed, because that makes you very depressed. And a friend of mine, Doug Boz, said, "You should go to see this therapist." And I went to see this therapist, and he said to me, "If you're thinking of killing yourself or doing anything terrible, let's make a deal." And the deal was, give me 6 months. So I thought, well, if I'm going to be around for 6 months, I may as well do something I've always wanted to do. And what I did was I created my first large-scale outdoor theater piece. Kind of in this something like Bread and Puppet, but not political and not so folky looking, more sophisticated looking, but similar in like large scale. And it was a combination of all the good artists that I've known for years because of all the work I had done, and locals.
And where did it take place?
At Rokeby.
Okay.
And for years, I did these big outdoor pageants. And they're not recorded in any way except in plates. So I have hundreds and hundreds of plates. So this is an event I did in 95 for the summer solstice. And There's a whole story. This is Thomas Workman. I don't know if you know him. He lives he plays Didge. This is, and I started, I've always, for many, many years, I've worked with different people.
Farmhouse we are in is surrounded by fields that stretch down to the Hudson River in long views of the Catskills. Everywhere one looks this day, there are people of various ages making skeletons, giant masks, or sewing costumes. I've long heard of Rokeby and its festivals, the numerous artists who've made it their home, and the way the place casts a magic spell over everyone who comes there. The estate was built up starting in 1815. It was home to the Astors and later the Aldriches, who still live there. It's truly unique, being simultaneously lived in and historic, future building and homey. How has it been for Gene Fleming to live and work out of this place for 40 plus years now?
I knew them because I was the first woman ice boater, and I used to ice boat. I had my own ice boat, and I knew Ricky Aldrich because of ice boating. And when this house came free, he offered it to me. When the guy who actually my house was sold, and I had to move, and this house came free, and they offered it to me, and that was 44 years ago. I've lived here for 40 years.
Okay.
And I started doing pageants here because Anya didn't speak English at that point, and she was really lonely and sort of desperate. She's an artist. And so I started creating things that Anya could make paintings for and stuff like that. And so we started doing these pageants, and then we did the pageants for, you know, any number of years. And during that time, I invented an article of clothing which caught on and made a lot of money. I was, now my husband Ralph and I were breaking up because
what was the article of clothing?
I think I have one upstairs. I created a scarf. It was called the hand scarf. And it was a scarf, and on the end of it were two stuffed hands. And I made it because I was going to the King Tut exhibit, and I knew I was going to be online for hours and hours. In those days, like, you waited 12 hours to get through that show. And I had been planning to go with my then-husband, Ralph, and Ralph and I were breaking up. He was a visual artist, a photographer, and he couldn't take the number of people that were in this house. Because we were were theater people, you know, and there was like always tons of people living here and staying here and in the mansion. And those days, I mean, I had people staying in the mansion. There were people here. There were people camped out. We were doing these big productions, one right after the other. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so I went to this exhibit and I made this scarf to keep me company while I was going to be online, that I could hold hands with it. And by the time I got off the line, I had about 60 orders for the scarf. And so it was coming up on Christmas time, and there was a craft fair at Bard. And so I thought, I'll just go over there and sell my scarves. So we all sat around. Here's the piece of dowel stuffing. I sewed. I was a costume maker, so I sewed all of them. And we stuffed all these hands, and we sewed them on these scarves. And we went to Bard, and I sold 400 of them. And then Sammy Davis Jr. wore one on national television. Uh-huh. It was a white silk one with black hands. And by then we were putting engagement rings on them because people were worried that their scarf would not be faithful to them because they got very attached to them. So I started sewing engagement rings on them. And ultimately I had to have them made by the Toy Works, which was up north. John Gunther, I met him because I started doing craft fairs. And then I started making other stuff. You know, I went from there. I was the first person to make magic fairy wands. You know, nobody was doing them back then, but I stuffed the star and I put a little flask in it, and you could put glitter in there and you could go like this and glitter would come out. Uh-huh. And I made magic fairy wands. And then I started making all kinds of other stuff. I just started making, I ended up making really expensive high fashion dresses, clothing. And I was in Women's Wear Daily, and I was one of America's top 500 craftspeople. I did the Rhinebeck Craft Fair. And that's how I supported my habit. And my habit was doing pageants. So I do a craft fair, make a shitload of money, do a pageant, spend it all. Do a craft fair, make a ton of money. And I did all the top shows. I did Rhinebeck and WBAI and Philadelphia Art Museum. And I did all those shows. So, yeah, I'd make a lot of money. I made a lot of money in that business. I had many people. I had 15 people working for me. You know, it was like the days of when I was running the arts program, Bill and Livia were just, from the Vannevar Caravan, were just coming to New Paltz. So I've known them for 35 years.
And was Ralph Lee moved up at that
point? Ralph, I didn't know Ralph until much later, because what happened with Ralph was that there were, now by this time I'm doing pageants and the pageants are getting to be well known. I became known as a person who did large scale outdoor work that was different from any what anybody else was doing. There was a woman named Karen Bacon who was doing things at the Bronx Zoo. Mm-hmm. It was the time of John, Lindsay, right? Mm-hmm. They were starting to do things in New York City that were called happenings. And I wasn't doing happenings, but I was doing things that were like happenings. And they were more, had more story attached to them. And I knew everybody. I knew all those people. My mentor was Ralph Burgard. Ralph Burgard started both the NEA and NISCA. He was one of the key people. He was like a heavy-duty art guy. And I met him because I was running this arts program, and I was trying to raise money for it. And everywhere I went, people would say, oh, I already gave my money to Ralph Burgard, because he was raising money for the Westchester Council for the Arts. And I called him up one day and I said, I don't know who you are, but you and I have to talk. You're taking all my money. And he and I met. We had dinner at the Gay Penguin in Westchester. And yeah, and that really changed my life, because the minute that I met Ralph, I moved in a way onto the national scene, because Ralph knew everybody. Ralph was the premier arts consultant in the country. It was his original ideas that were behind the NEA with Nancy Hanks and, you know, and NISCA with whoever those people were, I can't remember. I mean, you know, it's like hard to put that all together. And then I just remember in 76, Ralph and I were in Inwood Park, and that was the, you know, that was the, you know, the tall ships, you know, and all that. And I just remember saying, in 86, I'm going to be running this. And by 86, I ran the Statue of Liberty. I set that as a goal for myself, that I would be designing and running the Statue of Liberty celebration.
However, did a New York tradition end up based on a fabled estate in the upper reaches of the Hudson Valley? How does a kitchen filled with the sounds and smells of people making soup draw strategic phone calls from Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his staff? We sidetrack with Fleming's husband, Harlan, and stories about their wedding at the Mela Kumbh Mela in India some quarter century ago, and the amazed exclamations of son Jordi as he hears many of his mother's stories for the very first time. And so the story continues.
I have very strong opinions, and I can tell you that there's no way this is not going to upset me. It was a discussion.
This is what I was doing before you were born.
Seriously mismanaged funds.
Jordy's always figuring out the money, because I come from a really different place. Yeah.
Would you like a coffee?
Sure, I'll take a coffee.
He makes fabulous cappuccino.
And I can tell it's going to be good.
I make a little bit of noise, but I will make you a coffee that you
love. So let's see. What did you ask me?
The parade.
So what happened was I would do a pageant here for Frank's birthday, St. Francis of Assisi. Mm-hmm. We called him Frank. Bread and Puppet called him Frank. By this time, I knew everybody at Bread and Puppet. Margot Lee Sherman is born the same day that I am. You know, I knew all these people, and she used to do a funny thing about Frank's birthday. So we did a thing on October 4th for St. Francis of Assisi's birthday, which was called the Autumn Pageant. And we started calling them pageants because my landlord, Ricky, said, if you call them theater, nobody will come. I wanted all the locals to come. I always did this mix of amateur and professionals, mm-hmm. right? So that it always felt folk art. It wasn't even like Bread and Puppet. It was something different because they were engaged in something that was more sophisticated, that was based sort of on ancient mythic stories and nature mm-hmm. and stuff like that, as opposed to politics. And there'd always be parts of it. Like the music was always excellent. It wasn't funky. It was always excellent music, beautiful costumes, but happening in fields and stuff like that. So Ricky said, don't call it a theater piece because none of the local people will come. He said, call it a pageant. They'll think it's a beauty pageant and they'll come. And he was right. We called it a pageant and everybody wanted to come to Rokeby anyway because people love to come to the estates. And so we started developing an audience. I mean, by the end, thousands of people were coming, which became upsetting because there were too many people coming to Rokeby and... Mm-hmm. We sort of had to stop them. But I also did, like, New Year's Eve would be incredible. And everybody who lived here was working on my projects. In 86, when I did the Statue of Liberty, everyone on the estate was working on that project. Mm-hmm. And that went on for a long time. What happened was that there were a bunch of us, Marilyn Wood, Karen Bacon, Ralph Lee, me, I can't remember who else now. Oh, yeah, what's his name? He died. I can't remember. He did the Brooklyn Bridge celebration. Anyway, we all knew each other, and we had always gotten funding from the NEA and NISCA, and suddenly they didn't want to fund us anymore. They didn't know what we were, because we weren't doing theater. We were mixing it. Everything was mixed, and we were mixing professionals with amateurs, which they weren't funding amateurs. Mm-hmm. And we had this like weird thing going. Marilyn Wood did the Seagram's building, the huge dance piece in the windows of the Seagram's mm-hmm. building. Karen was doing Studio 54, and you know, this was the time. And so we all got together to figure out what we could call ourselves so that we could continue to get NEA and NISCA funding, because they were cutting us off. And so we decided that we were going to call ourselves Celebration Artists and have a new art form. And that's why to this day, if you notice the NISCA application, there will be a thing called either multi or other. And that was our great achievement. We got that category of multi or other as a category that could be funded by NISCA so we could get our work recognized and funded. And this... So I met Ralph at that meeting, and Ralph said he wasn't going to do the parade anymore.
And how long the parade had started?
It was in 74. 74 was the first parade. 73. This is the 40th annual. Bread and Puppet was not part of the Halloween parade later, until I took over, because Ralph and Peter don't get along. Ralph Lee was always jealous of Peter Schumann. Uh-huh. And they didn't get along, and Ralph wouldn't let his puppets in the parade. When I took over the parade, I invited Bread and Puppet to come. That's the first year they ever came.
Gene Fleming told me about the Halloween parade that took place within weeks of 9/11, the city's first big public event after its greatest tragedy. Complexities arose at the time, and the event organizer found herself having to convince one stalwart parading entity to step back because its contribution that year felt less insensitive to the mood of the city at the time. She explained how gauging the community was a part of what she did, no matter the pageant or event, and how she's learned to work with groups, accommodating various tastes while pushing her own sensibility over the years. Talk about a truly communal art form. We also spoke about recent years at the parade and her son Jordy's illness.
Alternative work. I have to work within the context of a major city. Mm-hmm. And you have to think of the community, you know, You have to think of public safety. You have to think of where everybody is, the neighborhood. We had done something for Katrina, we did something for Haiti, and then Occupy comes up. And I decided to allow Occupy to be in the parade. The police didn't want me to do that. And my feeling was that it was better to invite them in than to have them do a protest. And it turned out that the two boys who were organizing the puppets went to UConn, the puppetry program, and Basil Twist, who's a very close friend of the parade, and Basil had been their master puppeteer teaching person. So Basil skated down and made friends. You know, they all respected Basil. And Amy Trumpeter from Bread and Puppet, who lives in Rosendale, was I paid for the truck that took her puppets down and helped them. I helped them organize so that I had sense of where they were. I helped them to do everything. And then they made a decision at the last minute to go last in the parade, which meant they didn't appear on television, which was my biggest fear, was that they were going to lie down in the television spot with tens of thousands of people bearing down on them, and that I would have to call for them to be arrested, because somebody has to call the cops in. It would have been me. So I didn't want that to happen. So I figured that the best thing to do was to build trust within the group, because I believed in also what they were doing. I felt this is important. This is something that's happening in our time and that needs to be recognized. And so I helped them organize. And I wanted, if they decided to do something to wreck the event, to protest, no, of course I was trying to explain to them that we're them, we are like them, we're not, this is not the thing to destroy. You destroy this, there's nothing like it in New York City, there's nothing left like the Halloween. And if you ruin this, you've ruined the last opportunity for anything like this. We're having a float for heroes because my son, Jordy, had a kidney transplant this year. He got cancer when he was 7. And so that was when a lot changed, because once he got cancer, it was harder for me to have like 100 people in the house and stuff like that. And then as a result of that, his kidneys went when he was 13, and then he'd been getting like sicker and sicker over the years, and finally the jig was up. He had to have a transplant. And so one of the longtime parade volunteers offered to give him a transplant, gave him a kidney. So we're going to honor the people who, like, this was all happening right around when Sandy happened. He was scheduled for a transplant, and it had to be postponed because the mayor was thinking to postpone the Halloween parade for the very day he was supposed to have his transplant. And then we lost the transplant because we realized we couldn't do the parade and the transplant. And they said, oh, you'll get another one, and then we didn't get another one. It didn't happen. He was in an exchange, and no exchange came up, partly because his father was going to be the donor. But he was giving his kidney to a guy in Ohio, and then his counts got off, and they wouldn't accept his kidney. So now suddenly we had no kidney, and the mayor, of course, canceled the parade. So that was sort of, we lost both of those things at the same time. That's why we're doing a Kickstarter, and why I'm so tired.
Now, how did Center Claus?
Sinterklaas is a whole other thing. So there was a moment where I think I told you I designed these clothes and I did all these craft fairs, right? So the Rhinebeck Craft Fair, which was the premier craft fair in the country, moved out of Rhinebeck and moved to West Springfield. And when that happened, Bruce Lubman, who owns Hummingbird, which is a store in Rhinebeck, who did the craft fairs, actually was the guy who bought my first magic fairy wand. He was a jeweler, right? And Bruce came to me and said, the craft fair is leaving Rhinebeck. Nobody's going to remember Rhinebeck. Nobody's ever going to come here again. And he owned a jewelry store, so he was concerned about that. He said, would you create an event for us? Now, by this time, I can't remember if I had done the Statue of Liberty or not, but I run the 4th of July for New York City a few times. And I think the articles that appeared at that time in the newspaper were all about, yeah, and she's doing the Statue of Liberty, and she's going to do this thing in Rhinebeck too. I think that's what they were saying.
Sinterklaas coming up in a few weeks and involving both sides of the Hudson River in a rare gesture of togetherness started off as Old Dutch Christmas and then went dormant for years as Jean Fleming grew busy and the town of Rhinebeck changed its own ways. But it all came back a few years ago, bigger and better than ever, with thousands of kids in costume and their parents bowing down to create a sea of stars for their young ones, and the town elders playing Krumpuses in adaptation of the Black Peters of old. Fleming's stories of her process involving large meetings and yelling matches between village leaders, the taking of hostages, and much laughter, is a lesson in community organizing in modern art at its more immediate, and she's learned a great deal from it all, as could be expected.
You get into politics, you get into religion. When you do large-scale events, you see you aren't just working with artists, you're working with everyone. You have to get everybody to sign on, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, the police, the mayor, the churches, the Boy Scouts. You have to have everybody, right? Or it's not about the community. Mm-hmm. So you get everything, you know, you get all kinds of stuff. I mean, right now, the people who are against me in Rhinebeck are the conservative Jews, the Lubavitchers. I can't get those people to work with me. Mm-hmm. They just refuse. So they objected, so my funding from the town was cut. Because they said Sinterklaas was religious, which it's not. Mm-hmm. But the town didn't want to get into a whole controversy, and so they cut the funding. So I get no money from government to do that event. It's all private money, individuals.
And so it's been running how many years?
Well, what happened was, it's like 25 years ago or something, he asked me to create this event. So what I did was I got together a committee of 100, which was kids, oldest people in town, parents, all the clubs, everybody. And we came together in a charrette. In those days, the way I created an event was I had a charrette and I'd invite like 100 people and everybody who would have good ideas. And we had three big pieces of paper up on the wall. One was, when should it happen? What should it be about? Who is it for? And everybody in the room had ideas. And every idea was written down. All ideas were good. And at the end of the night, and I fed everybody. I always feed everybody. That I could, like, for an old bread and puppet thing, you know, you feed everybody, and, you know, so I always feed everybody all the time. So everybody was happy. They were eating donuts and coffee and, you know, and coming up with millions of ideas. And then at the end of the night, we voted. Everyone could vote as many times as they wanted on everything. So everybody voted. At the end of the night, we tallied it up, and what we found was they wanted to have an event for children based on the Dutch history of the town at the holiday time, sometime around the holiday. And I left to go and invent whatever this thing was going to be. And within 2 weeks, I found Sinterklaas. But when I brought it back, finally, after many, many years, because everyone begged me to do it. In fact, I stopped going into Rhinebeck because I couldn't go into town without somebody saying, "Won't you do Old Dutch Christmas again?" And it was my favorite event. I adored it. In the old days, it was lit with torches. Mm-hmm. It was fantastic. And so finally, Jordy was well enough, and I decided that, you know, that I could take on another big project. And so I said I would do Sinterklaas again. 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. So that was in 2008, because the next year, 2009, the second one, I did the opening of the walkway on October 9th, Halloween on the 31st, and then on the 30th, Sinterklaas arrived, and on December 1st, the big festival happened, because Sinterklaas is in two parts. He arrives a week before and
walks. And so then you just take some time?
Yeah.
Refueling?
I'm usually pretty exhausted at that point. And then I just take off time until I have to start doing the taxes, because I run all these not-for-profit arts organizations that produce all these things. So I have to do all the taxes. And usually by March, I can see straight. And then it's time to plant the garden.
And how has Rokeby in this house and this fed all of this over the years?
Well, I don't believe I could have done anything I did if I didn't live here. Because I needed a physical plant, you know. I mean, I need Ricky Aldrich, who, you know, is one of the three people who, you know, owns Rokeby. And then the girls, I mean, the five girls who own Rokeby, you know, I've been involved with them their whole lives. None of them were born when I moved here. So, you know, mm-hmm. Sophia, who's making the puppets, she's 38. I've lived here for 44 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Alex Kahn is building the puppets. I think he was 2 when I first met him.
How does Rokeby operate? How many people are at Rokeby now?
Well, now I think there must be something like 22 or 23 people. It's a lot different now than it was. For years, it was really this very unified community. And then various things happened, you know. The other brothers and sisters became more involved. It was kind of like, for years, it was Ricky and Anya and us, and we just did all these incredible things. And then the others are more conservative. One was living in Europe. She moved back. The other brother became more involved in the place. They didn't want a lot of people here. They started to worry about insurance. And, you know, so it started to change in terms of, like, what we could do. And then Jordy got sick. Oh, here's Peter. That changed things. Hi.
Hi.
People come and go from Jean Fleming's home, drawn by her open-hearted creativity, the warmth of what she's helped Rokeby become and stay. I love this place and want to stay days, meeting new folk, spinning yarns, and listening to grand tales of great accomplishments and sublime dreams. But I realize my time is running out, literally in terms of this recording. And I ask this woman I admire so to show me a bit of her treasures. Of course, she obliges with a tour, of which we shall hear a bit here.
This is the dairy cottage.
Okay.
I'll take you on. You can see where we used to build the old parade. You can come and see.
Okay, then, yeah, I'm going to have to.
You know, there are odd things all around here. The house is really, it's been a production place for so long. This is my office, which is really a mess. But you see, you know, traces of things. This is from Sinterklaas. This is from old pageants. I mean, there's such things. This is from the Halloween parade. There's all kinds of all kinds of stuff here. This is actually, this is when I did the Statue of Liberty, and this Amy Trumpeter made this. And this was on the Customs House. And
oh, wow.
What it was we had it, I gave her a birthday party, basically. And this was this was 100 feet tall. This was the model she made for me. And so when the moment came that we all sang happy birthday to her, she rose out of, she folded up and went up the entire Customs House in New York, filled that whole archway. And this was the model for that, how it was going to work. You know, all this stuff, gathering dust. You know, Sinterklaas is announced by paintings, not by, I don't like printed materials. Mm-hmm. I don't like computer generated. So what happens is the senior citizens and the seniors in high school paint signs and we hang them in the trees the week before, I guess, Thanksgiving. We hang all these. Now there are 400 of them. These are from the walkway. You know, I worked mm-hmm. with all 54 towns on both sides of the river. Yeah. And some of the artists who I knew just gave me their town emblems because the towns didn't want them. Most of them, the towns took them and put them in their town halls. But for these particular ones, these are, the horse is really important in Sinterklaas. Well, yeah, I didn't get to tell you that part. So we make about 500 of these every year and give them to the children. The story of the hobby horse. And invite all the children to be in the parade with their horses. These are all made with materials for the arts in New York.
Did you ever think this would you would enter into all of this? I mean, or has it just been this amorphous movement and growth over all these years?
It's just doing, you know, there was years and years ago, David Amram was part of something I was doing. And I had to talk to his manager, who was this really old woman, whose name I can't remember now. She was like already 80, or God, I'd swear she was 90. And I went to see her in her office in New York. You know, we had this planning this whole thing. And I said, how do you do it? How do you keep going? What's your secret? And she said, I just do the next thing and I do it well. And I sort of like adopted that, you know, it's like, do the next thing. I've never submitted a job application in my life. I just do the next thing. Whatever comes along is the next thing. And usually it comes out of the thing before or, you know, whatever. I was planning to retire, actually, and only do my own work, theatrical pageant, large rituals and things, because I do that too for small groups and stuff. And that was what I was planning to do many years ago when my husband made a bad investment. We lost all of our money. Uh-huh. And I couldn't stop. I had to keep going. It's 18 years I've been doing it since then. So that was the only thing that was different. I really wanted to do, I had a lot of ideas for just theater pieces I wanted to do, rituals, outside stories, mm-hmm. like, and that sort of changed when I had to earn all the money, so I kept doing that, and now it's like I'm 68, and I'm thinking, oh my God, guess we're not going to do that. But Jordy as well, that's the real key thing is that for the last 17 years, you know, I've been taking care of a very sick child. So now I just sort of feel like he's feeling great. I mean, he's always fabulous. He's always funny and bright and not acting sick and stuff. But now I feel like I finally can maybe look at doing it. It's when you have a sick child like that, it's you're always on the bottom line. You know, you don't. I don't know how to describe it, but after the transplant and when he finally felt good, like in April, it was like this huge weight was lifted off that I didn't even know I had. So I've been working for so many years just to keep him alive, keep the money coming in. So this is like the first time in a long time that I've had to like say, well, what do you want to do? You know, I mean, I wanted to do everything I did, but it's just different to think, well, if you had some time and you weren't worried about your kid and you weren't worried about money, what would you do? So I'm kind of thinking about that. I don't know what that is, because
that's what renewal's all about, right?
Well, yeah, revival, and yeah, and that has not been lost on me. That was my idea. It definitely has not been lost on me. So are they all there?
This has been Between the Lines, and today we've been at Rokeby, the 19th century mansion, now a hotbed for creativity, overlooking the Hudson and Catskills. Our interviewee has been the great Jean Fleming, mistress of the Greenwich Village Halloween Parade each October, as well as our region's own Sinterklaas celebration, which takes place the weekend of November 30th in Kingston, then on December 7th and 8th in Rhinebeck. Music for all this has been by Fleming's assistant, Matthew Foss's Balkan Parade Ensemble, the Raya Brass Band. My name is Paul Smart, filling in for this show's host and founder, Ann Forbes Cooper, who is working on her own creative projects these months. Until next month, take care.